the world of politics divides into two cohorts. And the larger one are people who run for public office because they want power or celebrity. They want to be something. Mm-hmm. And then there's the smaller, more admirable cohort who run for office because they want to do something, not just because they want to be something.
Few people know more about American politics than David Axelrod. Axelrod is the founding director of the University of Chicago's Nonpartisan Institute of Politics, a senior political commentator for CNN, and host of The Axe Files, which is one of my personal favorite podcasts. He's also the author of a best-selling memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. As Barack Obama's chief strategist and senior advisor, Axelrod helped to run both the 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns and knows better than most how a president gets reelected. Now, as President Biden ramps up for a general election rematch against Donald Trump, Axelrod is the perfect person to help us understand the contours of this presidential election. Axelrod and I spoke about his pivot from journalism to politics, what he's learned about how to run a successful reelection campaign, and what President Biden needs to do to beat Donald Trump in November. I'm Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent for Time, and this is Person of the Week. Can you tell me a little bit about how you talked about politics in your family when you were growing up? Was this something that you talked about around the kitchen table? Was it something your parents were interested in?
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that there was a lot of awareness about news and politics when I was a kid. My mother had been a reporter at the newspaper PM, which was a short-lived newspaper that was experimental. It was quite a paper. I.F. Stone and Max Lerner, and the cartoonist was a guy named Ted Geisel, who turned out to be Dr. Seuss.
Oh, wow.
And my father was a psychologist. He was a guy who was thoughtful about events, but he wasn't like obsessive about it. So, and then my folks split up when I was young. So I don't remember that many conversations around the kitchen table.
Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me a little bit more about your mother.
Yeah.
Because it was sort of unusual to be a newspaper reporter for a woman in the 1950s.
Listen, there were very few women in the newsroom in the 1940s. And she got in sort of through the back door because they had her cover education at first. You know, they figured that would be a good thing for a woman to cover. But yeah, it was remarkable because she was working when she went to journalism school. And she was the editor of the NYU newspaper. So she would work during the day. She'd take courses at night. And then she'd go to make sure that the paper was in shape. And she just was incredibly driven and, you know, very able writer.
Is that your dog in the background?
Yes, that is authentic dog noise, by the way. anyway, but, you know, my interest in politics, I grew up in Stuyvesant Town, New York. Now it's like luxury rental. Then it was an austere housing development built for returning war veterans. And on October 27th of 1960, John F. Kennedy came to Stuyvesant Town in the middle of the day. Charlotte, it was 12 days before the election, and he made 10 campaign stops in New York City, none of them for money.
Wow.
Because New York was a swing state back then.
Wow.
And he came to Stuyvesant Town, and here he was, a young war hero. It was the middle of the day. My mother was at work, and this wonderful woman who looked after me took me out and put me on top of a mailbox, and I watched JFK give a speech, and I watched how people responded to him and, you know, the flags and just his voice booming off the building. And I was just completely entranced by this. I thought, this seems really important. And that was kind of a seminal event in my life. And I followed him religiously and his brother, Bobby. And when I was 9, I gave out leaflets for Bobby. And when I was 10, I broke with the Democratic Party because I thought they were running a hack for mayor. And I handed out leaflets for John Lindsay, who was a liberal Republican. And, you know, so all throughout my young life, I was involved in politics, and then, of course, got involved in sort of anti-war politics. So I was steeped in it, and the 60s, of course, was such a fascinating decade to grow up in, you know.
But so that visit, that pivotal visit from JFK, was it something that he said, or was it the way that people were responding to him? Why did that stick with you so much?
I mean, I was five, so, you know, now I know what he said because I was able to Google the speech that he made.
Mm-hmm.
And he said one thing that actually, I don't know if I subconsciously intuited what that meant, but he said, "I'm not here to say that if you elect me, everything will be good." He said, "Being an American citizen in the 1960s is a hazardous occupation filled with peril and also hope." And he said, "And we'll decide which path we take in this election." And the translation of that, in my mind, is politics is the way we in a democracy can grab the wheel of history and steer it in the direction that we think is best for our country and for the future. And that seemed like an awesome power.
Yeah.
To have this process seem very vital. You know, his brother said, the future's not a gift, it's an achievement, which I thought was so profound. And politics was the way you work on creating the future, that we're not just flotsam and jetsam on the waters of history, but we can actually row.
Yeah. And so you then went to the University of Chicago.
Yes.
What was campus politics like at that time, and how involved were you?
I came to Chicago because of politics. I came to Chicago because 4 years before I came, there was the Democratic Convention that dissolved into chaos and mayhem over the war and civil rights. I knew that there was this sort of nascent Black independent political movement. It was around the University of Chicago, and it just seemed that politics was everywhere in Chicago. But, you know, campus politics at the University of Chicago was a little muted because in 1969, a bunch of activists took over the administration building and camped out there for days and days and days until they finally walked out and all were arrested and expelled. So, I mean, obviously there was a lot of sentiment, but I at least was not involved. So I decided, you know, I'm going to just write. And I decided journalism was the way. And so first I started at the student newspaper, and I got a job at the Hyde Park Herald newspaper in Hyde Park, writing a political column. I mean, I walked in, I was 18 years old, I guess, and the guy who ran the place, he was a general manager, and he said, "Well, our political columnist just graduated from law school, and he's going to work at the Attorney General's office. Is that something you think you could do?" And I said, "Absolutely."
God, such a different era for journalism. You can walk into a newspaper and get a job like that. Well, first of all, that all those newspapers would exist.
No, I know. Well, that's a real problem for democracy we could talk about. But I mean, I'm so grateful for that experience. And, you know, I was a stringer for The Washington Post and for Time Magazine and for some other publications back then. In fact, the thing that suffered the most were my studies. I spent a lot more time talking to aldermen and ward committeemen than I did in the library. But when I got to my final year, I applied for an internship at the Chicago Tribune, and I was competing against all these journalism students, but they hired me, and it was life-changing. It was a life-changing experience for me.
Wow. So you spent 8 years covering politics for the Chicago Tribune.
Well, the first 2.5 were on nights.
Right.
So, I mean, I came there and I was very knowledgeable about Chicago politics by the time I arrived at the Tribune, because I had written this political column for 3 years. And I made it my business to know the Byzantine history of every one of the 50 wards. Mm-hmm. I knew all about every hack, every reformer, you know, everybody. I knew the playing field, but the city editor said to me, "You know what? You know more about Chicago politics than anybody I've got here, but you don't know yet everything you need to know about reporting."
Mm-hmm.
So I'd went on nights for 2.5 years, and they'd pull me off every once in a while to cover a campaign for a few weeks toward the end of a campaign, just to keep my appetite satisfied. And then I got shifted over to politics. So I was, you know, I guess I just turned 24. And then I covered politics for the next 5 years until I left the Tribune in 84.
So, you know, why did you decide to leave journalism and become a campaign consultant yourself? And also, what did you learn from journalism that made you so good at that?
Oh, my goodness. I always say I attended the University of Chicago and was educated at the Chicago Tribune. Almost everything useful I learned as a newspaper man. I arrived at the Tribune at sort of the golden age of Chicago journalism. The Tribune newsroom was just filled with talented reporters and editors and bustling with energy. And there was sort of the old front page spirit, you know, when they'd sent me out, you know, the guy on the desk would yell through this cavernous newsroom, Axelrod, hat and coat. And nobody wore hats anymore.
Yeah, what does he mean by hat?
Exactly.
Like, you're supposed to wear a fedora with a little feather that says press.
Exactly, you know? But this was like a tradition, and it meant we're sending you out.
Right.
But back to your question. I left because management changed at the Tribune. The focus suddenly shifted. There was a lot more focus on the bottom line. All the editors who I mentored under sort of left. But the main thing is I went off and covered the presidential race in 1984. And I came back from Iowa and I told them that Gary Hart, who was a young senator from Colorado, was going to make some noise. And they said, that's ridiculous. That's not going to happen. So he finishes second, and it's huge because it's like 12 people in the field. And Walter Mondale's the front runner, the former vice president. But now Hart is the guy who might challenge him. And we go to New Hampshire. And I told him New Hampshire's set up for Hart for the same reason that New Hampshire was good for independent candidates always. And he wins. And that night, I stayed up all night writing a column about where would he go now. They were going down south, much more conservative.
Right.
And I wrote the story. And when I got back to the newspaper, they had taken my quotes and the guy who was covering Mondale and kind of mashed it together, and they destroyed my piece. And I said, what am I doing out here? And Paul Simon, who was running for the Senate in Illinois, a congressman from downstate, not the singer, had approached me several times and asked me if I had come to work for him. And I finally said, yeah. He was an old newspaper man, by the way, so that made me feel better about crossing over.
When we come back, David Axelrod explains why the Affordable Care Act was so personal for him and what new political talent he sees on the horizon. More in a minute. So I want to ask you about your daughter, Lauren, who was born with epilepsy and lives with a developmental disability. What did you learn about healthcare policy in this country?
Yeah. Well, you know, Charlotte, that's the other reason I left the newspaper business.
Yeah.
Because Susan and I, we were quite young when we got married. And Lauren, 7 months after she was born, Susan found her in her crib. And she was having a seizure, but Susan didn't know what it was. And she raced to the emergency room. And I got there and I saw Lauren have a seizure. And it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And the doctor said, well, it's probably just related to a fever or an infection. She'll be fine in a few days. We got released a month later and she was still having 10 seizures a day.
Wow.
And in a very short order, you know, they were trying different medications and the medications were more and more expensive. And I had an HMO, it didn't cover prescriptions. And I learned very quickly that we couldn't move Lauren to a different insurance policy because she had a pre-existing condition. It was a nightmare and we almost went broke.
Wow.
And so, I mean, this is why I wept the night the Affordable Care Act was passed. You're all in the Roosevelt Room next to the Oval. And the votes were coming in. I got up before the final tally and I went into my office across the hall and I closed the door. And when I heard everybody cheer, I just broke down.
Wow.
And I sobbed. I didn't even know why at first. And then I realized it was because I knew there were families who wouldn't have to go through what my family went through. It's hard enough to have a child that sick and a child.
Of course.
Who, you know, there were times when we thought we were going to lose her, but then to wrestle with how to cover her medical expenses. I mean, it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
But the night that the Affordable Care Act passed, after I cleaned myself up, got myself together, I found the president and I said, I just can't thank you enough for the families like mine that won't have to go through what my family went through. And we'd been friends for a long time, so he knew all about it, you know. And he put his hand on my shoulder. He said, that's why we do the work.
Right.
And that was the single most clarifying thing that anybody's ever said to me. You know, in Washington, you get so caught up with who's up and who's down and whether the red team's winning or the blue team's winning. And you kind of lose sight of the fact sometimes that lives hinge on what's happening there.
Right.
And we really did something. Mm-hmm. And it was meaningful and important. And politics allowed us to do that. Government allowed us to do that. And I always try and remind people of that because we get so absorbed in the game of politics. And there's a lot of gamesmanship in politics, but the outcomes are really important to people's lives.
Yeah. You know, you are this household name, partly because you're one of the people who made Barack Obama president, who advised him throughout much of his presidency, who advised his reelection campaign. But I'm really curious, you know, given that we are now in a presidential reelect.
Yeah, we are.
With Joe Biden running for reelection. What are your memories of Joe Biden as vice president during that mm-hmm. time?
Well, listen, my impression of him, I really loved having him in the White House because he was a guy who was fearless about voicing his opinions, like during the meetings about what to do in Afghanistan. He was willing to take on the military in a way others just wouldn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guy who really pushed middle-class economics when the discussion was very much about what do we do to keep the financial system from collapsing. And he's like, you know, what about the people who are losing their homes? What about the people who are losing their jobs? He was very, very good on all of that. And he did his job really well. He ran the Recovery Act for us, and it was impeccably good. He was a meaningful player in that administration, a tremendous asset, I thought.
Yeah. So I want to talk about 2012, because that was, the last successful reelection campaign of a Democratic president. Mm-hmm. In fact, the last successful reelection campaign of any president. How was Obama doing at this point in the cycle in 2012? Was he in as deep trouble as Joe Biden seems to be?
No. I mean, first of all, he wasn't running against Donald Trump, who
right.
is a deeply flawed candidate. And ultimately, Biden, I think, can win this race because of Trump's flaws. But he also, you know, Mitt Romney, for whom I have a great deal of respect, was not as dynamic a candidate as Trump
mm-hmm.
is. So it was an entirely different thing. The thing that was the same was that we were coming through the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and there was still such an overhang from it in terms of homes lost, jobs lost.
Right.
And so even though we were making progress, people really didn't want to hear that. We had to really think hard about the story we wanted to tell about the economy, because the economy was going to define that election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I'm curious, you know, having gone through that election,
mm-hmm.
now we're past Super Tuesday. This is firmly a Biden-Trump race.
Yes.
What are you looking for and what are you worried about?
Well, look, I think I saw some of what I was looking for in the State of the Union speech. And I'm not talking about energy, although that was essential. I think what
yeah.
he mostly accomplished in his State of the Union speech, President Biden, was to quell the nerves of a lot of anxious Democrats. That may not hold for that long, but at a critical moment, he came through. But the bigger thing was messaging-wise, I think that the agenda that he outlined that was very much focused on the cost of living
mm-hmm.
and the viability of middle-class families, I think that is where he needs to go, and he needs to hammer away at that. And in that sense, it's the same as 2012. The thing that worries me is that he seems determined to want to get credit for, as he said in the speech, the greatest economy in the world. Well, it may be the greatest economy in the world, but if people aren't feeling it, you can't jawbone them into feeling it. And the reason they're not feeling it is costs.
Right.
So at least give a disclaimer saying it doesn't matter how high the stock market goes. It doesn't matter whether our unemployment numbers are stellar. It doesn't. None of this matters if people go to the store and feel they can't afford their groceries, if people can't afford their rent or their mortgage, if people can't afford their prescriptions. That is where I think he needs to spend a lot of time. I mean, no one cares more about this issue of democracy than me. I think that Donald Trump, his kind of casual sundering of rules and laws and norms and institutions is a death knell for democracy if we were to follow him down that trail. We saw what it leads to. That said, if you're sitting around the kitchen table talking about the future of democracy, it's probably because you don't have to worry about how much those groceries cost that you're eating.
Right. Well, so listen, as somebody who has been inside an administration and also helped run a major reelection campaign, if you had been on the Biden team, would you have recommended that he run again?
Well, I made my views pretty clear publicly. I mean, all I'm going to say is what I said, which is, you know, age is going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And he ought to think about whether it's in his best interest and the best interest of the country for him to run under these circumstances with Trump on the other side. He made that decision. So what I would or wouldn't have advised him was probably not that useful right now. But, you know, look, I think he's been a highly competent president. I think he's got historic accomplishments. I think the infrastructure bill and some of the healthcare and pharmaceutical initiatives and climate change, these are major accomplishments. And that doesn't just happen. It happens because you and your team have made it happen. So I don't question his ability right now or whether he's running the government or whether he's running it effectively. But I do know that you are judged a lot by how you appear in front of a camera.
Yeah.
And there, I think, you know, age has taken a toll. And that's a worry.
Yeah. I mean, listen, given that age is probably a big problem for him, what advice would you give him to navigate that?
Well, I think that there is a case to be made here. He's been making it in a way by saying it's not the age of the person, it's the age of their ideas. If you look at the things I mentioned, the things that he's done, they are all with an eye to the future.
Yeah.
That infrastructure law is going to have impacts that are going to pay dividends for generations. The climate stuff is about future generations, protecting women's reproductive rights. It's going to affect future generations. And I think you can make a very strong, straight-faced argument that while neither Trump nor Biden may have long futures, only one of them has really been focused on building a future for the rest of us and for our kids and grandkids. And Biden ought to claim that, because what you have in Trump is a guy who's very much focused on his own past and on retribution. And that's not going to solve anybody's problems. That's just going to create more chaos and more bitterness and disruption. And I would make that case for him. And I think it's the case that he should make for himself. I'd also like to see, you know, we keep hearing about the stuff he says in private and the stuff he says in fundraisers. I don't think there's anything wrong with going out and saying that Donald Trump is a crazy SOB or calling him out on some of his stuff. And I think a little bit of edginess is feistiness that people need to see.
What do you think is underneath Trump's resurgence here? I mean, I feel like after January 6th, people thought, okay, he's done.
Yeah.
You know, he's left the presidency. There's just been an insurrection. You know, a lot of people disapprove of what happened on January 6th. Then many of Trump's candidates lost in the 2022 midterms. How is he back? What do you think explains that?
Well, first of all, we should have taken a clue from what happened relative to January 6th. The speed with which Kevin McCarthy and the House Republicans fell in line, you know, how few Republicans voted to convict him in the Senate, including Mitch McConnell. And that should have been a reflection of Trump's residual strength within the Republican Party. which was apparent in the timidity of Republicans unwilling to take him on. But I think, too, that there is a tremendous kind of PTSD from the pandemic that is with us today. I think the inflation that resulted from the pandemic and the effects of that are still with us today. But I also think people are just not in a good mood.
And why do you think that is?
Because I think there is a sense that things are kind of out of control. I think the pandemic felt that way. You know, I think the border stuff does, the border crisis does add to that. And then, look, you cannot overestimate the impact of these indictments within the Republican Party. Each time one of these indictments happened, people say, well, geez, he's not going to survive that. How many times in the career of Donald Trump are we going to say, well, he can't survive this, he can't survive that?
Right. So what is the impact of that?
The impact was it made him indomitable within the Republican primaries. And that sense of indomitability is what's propelling him, both his resilience in winning primary after primary and his resilience in resisting and fighting these legal battles, I think have rebuilt this aura of the indomitable guy. And in this particular race, if you look at what they believe is Biden's greatest weakness, it's weakness. It's this perception of weakness. I mean, if you really boil the Republican message down, the real message is that the world's out of control and Biden's not in command.
Right.
That's their message. And Trump has been pumped up through this last year and a half. I mean, he was at a weak point after the midterms when he was being blamed for Republican losses. But these indictments in some ways saved him and allowed him to rebuild his base within the Republican Party. And that puts him in a position to win. Not saying he's going to.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's in a much stronger position than anyone would have imagined.
So you really helped to pioneer this social media strategy that helped Obama win twice, or you were at least on.
Our team did.
Your team did.
Right.
But now that social media strategy looks very different,
yes,
and now social media is a much more hospitable place for Republicans than Democrats, do you feel like Obama kind of opened a little bit of a Pandora's box here?
Well, look, we did use social media to our advantage, I think in much more wholesome ways than you see today. You know, we built a whole national movement on social media. It was primitive in its form at that time. The thing that changed social media so dramatically, and we worked with the beginnings of this in 2012, but the availability of big data and the ability to weaponize social media in the way that it's being weaponized today. Mm-hmm. I mean, the basic model of the social media companies is to keep people online, and their great inspiration or that of their algorithms is the way to do it, is to appeal to their anger, outrage, fear, resentment, and then drive them into their silos where they will stay and where they will be online perpetually to look at advertising and other promotions. The result of it is that outrage is profitable, and it's profitable both for the social media platforms, but it turns out that it's profitable in politics.
Hmm.
I mean, look at who the great fundraisers in the Republican Party are. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I think is crazy, is raising millions and millions of dollars because she appeals to outrage, she appeals to resentment, she traffics in conspiracy theories, and this is the currency of social media. I think it's interesting that Trump, who wanted to do away with TikTok when he was president, is now their defenders against legislation that could sideline them. Why? Because it's become a powerful weapon for his side. So listen, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I do think we need more regulation, but we should recognize what the social media world is, and we should recognize that our politics has more and more come to mirror that world. And that's not good for democracy.
So one last question. Who do you think is the next David Axelrod?
Oh my.
Are there other David Axelrods out there?
Listen, there are so many smart young people out there. I know some people who impress me, the young guys who are running the Future Forward Super PAC, for example, or guys who worked in our campaigns. I have no doubt that there are people who can be great and are great and are great, are showing their greatness in campaigns, perhaps below the presidential level. And there are some who will be stars in this campaign, you know, and I really hope that's the case, because the thing that keeps me hopeful is young people who are skeptical but not cynical. And I always say democracy is an ongoing battle between cynicism and hope. And if young people abandon hope, then the cynics will, that it will be like, you know, the end of the game. I know a lot of young people from the Institute of Politics who are out there. One of them's running the voter protection program in Wisconsin for Democrats. One of them's a solicitor general, you know, in Iowa, who's a conservative Republican.
Right.
But they're grounded people. And there are tons of people I've seen and I've met, who I've worked with, who've gone on and are out there doing things in the public square. And they give me hope every day.
Right. David, it's been so great talking to you about your years in politics and getting some insights from you about what's happening in this presidential election. But now I want to get to know you a little bit more in a segment we like to call The Last Time. I know, get ready. Okay, when is the last time you saw a game at Wrigley Field?
It would be last September. I may have been there for the last game of the season, and I've already seen my first game of the spring because I'm in Arizona right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm pretty hardcore.
Okay. When's the last time you had a Chicago style hot dog?
It may have been at the ballpark. No, I've been to White Sox games too, but at one or the other of those games, I had a Chicago style dog.
And when's the last time you visited DC?
I was there not long ago. I'm trying to remember why. Oh, I think I had a speech there and I did some things on CNN, and it was probably in January.
And when's the last time you were surprised by an election result?
Huh. Well, I mean, I have to confess, and I was behind the curve on this. I thought that the midterms in 2022 would be worse for Democrats than they were. And of course, that's something that the Biden folks point to all the time when people gainsay his chances in this election. But that's
right.
Certainly what I thought the results were surprising. And I think often about, well, what did I miss and why?
Mm-hmm. And when is the last time you spotted a new political talent?
Oh, my. You know, I've got my eyes open all the time. I did a podcast with Mallory McMorrow from Michigan, who is someone I think everyone should keep their eye on. But I'm always excited when I see young people with talent, you know, moving their way up through the system. I mean, that's the great hope.
Listen, David, I really appreciate you making the time to speak with us. Thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
If you want to hear more from David Axelrod, you can tune in to his podcast called The Axe Files. Thank you so much for listening to Person of the Week. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you. So send your tips or thoughts on our show to personoftheweek@time.com. I'm Charlotte Alter. See you next week.
Person of the Week is hosted by Charlotte Alter. It's produced by Nina Bisbano and Allison Bailey. Our senior producer is Ursula Summer. Our story editor is Katie Feather. This episode was mixed by Joe Plord. Our theme music was composed by Billy Libby. Joseph Frischmuth is our fact checker. Person of the Week is a co-production of Time Studios and Sugar 23. At Time, our executive producers are Dave O'Connor, Michael Erlinger, and Sam Jacobs. At Sugar 23, our executive producers are Mike Mayer, Michael Sugar, and Liam Billingham. Sasha Mathias is the head of audio at Time. You can find us online at time.com/personoftheweek and wherever you get your podcasts.